vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting not live, but still from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd.
And I'm Maya Ibbotson.
Today we broadcast from the Jiuxiaige, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations.
Unfit's feature today focuses on the uptick in Western anti-Asian sentiment, notably exacerbated by the pandemic. Though this xenophobia is not new, COVID-19 has heightened pre-existing cultural notions and stereotypes surrounding the East Asian diaspora. The result has been a horrific increase in vandalism of Asian businesses and hate crimes against Asian people, which has made headlines in the US and Canada as well as elsewhere. For this audio essay, we're going to give a brief history of anti-Asian sentiment in the US and Canada, supported by a few public policy decisions and events that have since fostered negative perceptions of Asian peoples in the West. Then we will be interviewing a friend of the show, Amanda Chu, who is a U2 Honors GSFS student at McGill. We talked to her about her work on anti-Asian racism in regards to the pandemic, the model minority myth, and resources. I want to issue a content warning as this interview has mentions of death, racism, violence, mentions of slurs, but not explicit, enslavement, murder, and police brutality. But don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after a short music break.
Caught up in me.
That was Rocky by Still Woozy, followed by 347 Aiden with Dancing in My Room. Now for our weekly headline roundup. As reported by the Globe and Mail, a hunger strike has been staged at a Laval, Quebec immigration detention center, specifically amidst concerns of inhumane conditions at the facility in the face of the pandemic. Several men in the Laval facility refused food this past week in protest. This is the third hunger strike at this holding center since COVID-19 hit Quebec in March, as reported by Solidarity Across Borders. In an interview with the Globe and Mail, inmate and Colombian immigrant Carlos Martin began his hunger strike on March 1st, as he had been held in the center for almost 60 months and worried that the novel coronavirus variants would make their way into the center. In the interview, Martin states that, quote, "I know what the symptoms are, and I've seen some guards that had the same symptoms that I had and didn't use gloves, that took off masks," unquote. In a letter to the Solidarity Across Borders activist group, the six inmates in question who are participating in the hunger strike discuss the conditions in further detail. A quote detailing the conditions is as follows, quote, "For some time now, the COVID virus has entered the prison. The sanitary measures taken by the immigration officers are clearly insufficient. Some of the detainees have already contracted COVID. Others complained of pain similar to the symptoms of COVID, but were given only Tylenol. We are in a lot of pain. We had also been confined to separate rooms without receiving any psychological assistance. We are distraught and very fearful for our health. In our opinion, using detention as an immigration policy is in all times an inhumane and unjust measure, with or without COVID," unquote. To take action regarding this crisis, you can visit the page that Solidarity Across Borders has set up to help out by calling your local MPs or signing petitions. The link will be in our resource list and our link tree.
As reported by ABTN News last week, quote, an open letter is blasting Quebec Premier François Legault and his Coalition Avenir Quebec, CAQ, government for failing to adopt Choice's principle and recognize that systemic racism exists in the province healthcare system, unquote. According to Choice Principle's website, quote, Choice Principle demands that all Indigenous people have equal right to the highest standard of physical and mental health, with a right to traditional medicines and their conservation of their vital medicinal plants, animals, and minerals, unquote. However, in November, this adoption of the principle did not pass in Quebec because of its use of systemic racism. Indigenous academics, advocates, and physicians are calling out for the adoption of Joyce's principle. Dr. Samir Shaheen Hussein, a Montreal pediatrician and author of Fighting for a Hand to Hold, Confronting Medical Colonialism Against Indigenous Children in Canada, wrote to Premier Legault in an open letter stating that the colonial legacy in healthcare not only needs to be acknowledged, but also solved within healthcare. She urges to implement the principle, which, quote unquote, centers the autonomy and self-determination of Indigenous peoples and communities over their own health and social services, unquote. Dr. Darlene Kitty, an EU Cree family physician, in a James Bay community in northern Quebec, states that there have been numerous reports and investigations proving systemic racism does exist within the province, including the Viennes Commission. Wanda Gabriel, a Ginaganage and Kenistake Associate Professor of Social Work at McGill University, chimed in saying, quote, that she had, quote, heard stories of racism and discrimination throughout her 30 years of experience as a social worker. Alicia Tukey-Pick, the first Inuk woman to run in a provincial election in 2018 and local Montreal advocate, explains that, quote, the systemic racism that they deny shouldn't have gone this far. It's obvious that it exists, especially with Indigenous people. It's our culture, it's our lives. It affects a lot of my family members. As Inuk, I am scared to go to clinics. I'm scared to be stopped by police officers, unquote.
On May 25th, 2020, George Floyd was killed at the hands of the Minneapolis police. Yesterday, the trial against Derek Chauvin, the cop who killed him, was supposed to begin. However, the jury selection was paused. Chauvin faces second-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter charges, with third-degree murder charges to potentially be tacked on by judges this week. On the murder charge, prosecutors must show, quote, beyond a reasonable doubt that Chauvin caused Floyd's death while assaulting him, unquote, according to the Washington Post. State sentencing in Minneapolis shows an average 11 years in prison for someone who is convicted of such a murder charge when they have previously had no criminal history. The manslaughter charge carries a presumptive 4 years in prison. Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, when speaking to the press, states that he will argue his client is not guilty as he was acting in self-defense. The other three officers implicated in Floyd's death, Jake Hung, Thomas Lane, and To Thao, will face trials in August, charged with aid to murder and manslaughter. It's necessary to stay on top of happenings as such in order to keep the momentum of this summer's conversations and continue larger conversations surrounding racial inequity and Black Lives Matter. To watch the trial, the Washington Post will be providing live coverage on its website and on its YouTube channel, with staffers reporting from the courthouse in Minneapolis. The trial is set to span until late April or early May, when the jury will begin deliberating their decision.
Now it is time for our COVID-19 weekly update. As stated by the Montreal Gazette, quote, Quebec expects 113,000 AstraZeneca vaccine doses this week. Quebec has so far received 638,445 vaccine doses. By the end of March, it expects another over 1.1 million doses, the provincial government announced Monday, unquote. This Thursday will be a day of remembrance for those who have lost their lives to COVID-19 in all provinces. According to the Montreal Gazette, quote, the Quebec government announced it would spend $23.1 million to provide assistance to female entrepreneurs and workers whose businesses and careers have been disrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic, unquote. Variant cases are on the rise in the province, with a total of 255 cases reported thus far. As of Monday at 11:05 a.m., the Gazette reports there are 579 new cases in the province, the fewest reported cases since September. Hospitalizations are also on decline since November. That was our weekly headline roundup. Now it's time for a couple quick groovy tunes and then our audio essay.
taking my shitty, but I ain't bringing no friends with me. Blaming your bones, acting like you got somewhere to be. Don't get me started. Don't get me started. Take it how you want it.
Back to Unfit to Print. That was Cosmo Pike with A Piper for Janet and Don't Get Me Started by Sports.
Now it's time for our segment on anti-Asian racism. As I mentioned before, countries such as the US and Canada have seen a surge in anti-Asian hate crimes in this past year, largely attributed to the COVID-19 pandemic and the rhetoric surrounding its origins. For this segment, we want to dive deeper into these issues by providing a brief historical context on anti-Asian racism and policy in the West. Then we interviewed Amanda Chu about her work on anti-Asian racism in regards to the pandemic, as well as the model minority myth, and talked about some resources. Again, there is a content warning for this interview, as it has mentions of death, racism, violence, mentions of slurs, but not explicit, enslavement, murder, and police brutality. But besides that, we're going to play and we hope you enjoy.
In the past year, countries such as the US and Canada have seen a surge in anti-Asian hate crimes. This anti-Asian discrimination, although not new, is being exacerbated by the pandemic, specifically rhetoric used to describe and discuss the COVID-19 virus. This surge in discrimination and violence is demonstrated by the attacks and vandalism of Asian businesses, along with the violence against older Asian folks. According to Today, quote, in the San Francisco area, home to the nation's largest and oldest Chinatown, there have been at least 18 attacks against Asian individuals this month. In 2020, New York City police recorded 28 hate crimes against Asian Americans, up from 3 in 2019. Unquote. In spring 2020, a group of activists began a national online system for tracking discrimination and violence against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, known as AAPI Hate. Between March and December of that year, the system received 2,800 reports of hate incidents.
In September 2020, the U.S. passed Res 908, a resolution that calls on all public officials to condemn and denounce anti-Asian sentiment, racism, discrimination, and religious intolerance related to COVID-19. Furthermore, it demands federal law enforcement, both state and local officials, to investigate and document all credible reports of hate crimes and threats against the Asian American community, as well as persecute perpetrators. The resolution also aims to combat misinformation that perpetuates discrimination against Asian Americans. Moreover, it calls on government leadership to prioritize inclusive language. This resolution promises to effectively condemn this discrimination. However, minimal coverage and discussion of this surge in violence against Asian and Pacific Islander communities remains a considerable issue in both journalism and politics. In order to better understand how to combat this violence and hold each other accountable, we must also understand the long but ignored history of anti-Asian racism. In 1882, American Congress, under President Arthur's term, enacted the Chinese Exclusion Act. It was the first limiting immigration law, leading to a 10-year ban on quote-unquote Chinese labor immigration, as stated by Today. This discrimination against laborers continued in some form or another until 1943. The association of Chinese folks with disease began before COVID-19. According to Today, quote, perceptions in the 19th century that Chinese immigrants were the source of diseases like smallpox, leprosy, and malaria played a role in the Act's passage, as did the fears they were taking away jobs from white workers. At the time, many Chinese folks were out of work after helping in the 1860s to build the Transcontinental Railroad, completing the most dangerous jobs on the toughest parts of the route and earning roughly one-third less than white workers. Unquote. Beth Lou Williams, history professor at Princeton University and author of The Chinese Must Go, Violence, Exclusion, and the Making of the Alien in America, explains that the history of violence against Asian Americans was able to be overlooked and suppressed because, quote, the violence was meant to push people out of communities, and in many communities, they succeeded, unquote. In 1900, in San Francisco, the body of a Chinese man was discovered, and investigations suggested the man passed away from the bubonic plague. As a result, the health department in San Francisco shut down its Chinatown, quarantining the entire neighborhood. Russell Jung, professor at San Francisco State University and co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate, explains that, quote, they allowed white people to leave, but they kept the Chinese folks segregated there to get the disease. The actual neighborhood was roped off some, barbed wire was put up, and that's their approach to dealing with the disease. Unquote. According to Jung, quote-unquote arbitrary health conditions was the justification for the quarantine at the time. In the 1880s, Canada began its construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway. By the end of the project, 6,500 of the 9,000 workers were Chinese individuals. According to the BC government website, quote, Chinese workers were paid $1 a day, and from this dollar, they had to pay for their food and gear. White workers were paid $1.50 to $2.50 per day and did not have to pay for provisions. As well as being paid less, Chinese workers were given the most dangerous tasks, such as handling the explosive nitroglycerin used to break up solid rock. Due to the harsh conditions they faced, hundreds of Chinese Canadians working on the railway died from accidents, winter cold, illness, and malnutrition. Unquote. In fact, newspapers and advertising often depicted Chinese laborers in a negative and degrading way, implying that Chinese workers should be paid less for their labor. Furthermore, the Canadian government enacted the 1885 Chinese Immigration Act. This immigration act, similar to the one in the U.S., was the first in Canada to exclude and discriminate against one's racial background. Furthermore, under the act existed the Chinese head tax. Starting at $50, according to the Canadian Encyclopedia, quote, the tax was later raised to $100 and then $500. During the 38 years the tax was in effect, around 82,000 Chinese immigrants paid nearly $23 million in tax. The head tax was removed with the passing of the Chinese Immigration Act in 1923. Also known as the Chinese Exclusion Act, it banned all Chinese immigrants until its repeal in 1947. Unquote. The tax was a result of the completion of the railway. The Canadian government decided that since there was no longer a need for labor from Chinese individuals, they would instead tax them in exchange for citizenship. On top of the head tax, the Chinese Immigration Act contributed to the institutional racism that led to denying, quote, Chinese people the right to vote, to practice law or medicine, to hold public office, to seek employment on public works, or to own crown land, among other restrictions, unquote. These discriminatory policies contribute to a structural inequality that remains persistent today. As stated by NBC News, quote, hunger and food insecurity are perennial but often invisible problems among low-income Asian Americans. The COVID-19 pandemic, which has heavily affected many of the industries that employ low-income Asian Americans, including restaurants, salons, and small factories, has exacerbated their economic hardship and highlighted the challenges in helping them. In response, community organizations from Philadelphia to San Francisco are now trying to meet urgent demand for food by distributing free meals and groceries. Poverty amongst Asian Americans in the U.S. is high. In New York, for instance, one in four Asian individuals live in poverty, and half have limited English, according to the nonprofit Asian American Federation, or otherwise known as AAF. In Boston, meanwhile, poverty among Asian individuals was nearly 26.6%, according to a 2014 report from the Boston Redevelopment Authority. Unquote. The events I previously mentioned are just a few historical incidents that demonstrate the legacy of anti-Asian racism in both America and Canada. This history is vital in understanding present-day discrimination. As someone who grew up in the Canadian school system, there needs to be a greater emphasis on anti-Asian racism both in the past and present. With that historical context, I will now play my interview with Amanda Chu. Amanda spoke with me about her work regarding anti-Asian racism in the pandemic, the model minority myth, and resources. I want to issue a content warning for those just joining us now. This interview has mentions of racial violence and enslavement. So, as mentioned earlier on the show, we are now with Amanda Chu. Amanda is a U3 student at McGill, majoring in GSFS. She's currently working on her thesis in East Asian feminism. And Amanda is also a representative from the Pan-Asian Collective, as well as a member of QPIRG. So now we welcome you. Thank you for coming into my living room, also our living room. Hi.
Thank you for having me in my home.
So just for reference, we are roommates. So this is all COVID safe. So my first question for you is, how has your perspective on anti-Asian racism fueled by the pandemic changed since you released your article entitled We Are Not the Virus at the start of the pandemic?
I think things have for sure changed in the sense that obviously everything feels a bit more serious now, not saying that it wasn't serious before, but it's definitely a lot more frightening and something that as an Asian person, as a visibly Asian person, is very taxing when every time you go out on the street wearing a mask, not wearing a mask, doing whatever you're doing, it's definitely scary. But I think at the same time, my opinion has stayed the same, and if not, has been actually reinforced by everything that has been going on, because in my article, We Are Not the Virus, which was written like about a year ago, I talk about how the racism is possible because anti-Asian racism as a whole is not discussed enough and is not prevalent enough in mainstream media. And as a lot of us have seen, maybe on Instagram, depending on who you follow or what news you're looking at, it still hasn't been discussed and it's gotten a lot more serious. And there have actually been petitions made to get anti-Asian racism in mainstream media coverage. But just looking at the failure of the media to cover these sorts of things when the attacks have gotten drastically more violent and serious and common kind of just reinforces what I said or what I thought a year ago.
Sort of going off of that point about media, one of my questions was, how has the media handled covering this issue? And you sort of answered that, but I'm wondering, going off of that, when they are covering it, what are they missing? What are they not doing the best? They're covering it poorly. They're not covering it enough. But what could they be doing to, I don't know, report on it in a way that is helpful and, you know, progressive and productive?
Well, I think one thing that we've seen, and also, I mean, the whole Black Lives Matter movement was separate from Asian racism. And I don't think that, I think that the Black community experiences a very different, you know, level of racism that I can't speak to as an Asian person. But also, we're seeing that a lot of the media that covered at least the Black Lives Matter protests, if not the actual instances, the Black Lives Matter protests are failing to cover. There was a very large demonstration done downtown New York about a week ago against anti-Asian racism. They had to close down the streets, but no one saw that on the news. And it's interesting to see kind of the failure to do so, because, again, there's not really a space for dialogue surrounding anti-Asian racism. It's very nuanced. And I think that because it has not been talked about for so long, because diversity is often seen as black and white instead of black, white, and everything in between, it can be hard to be pushed to the margins. But at the same time, we do have the privilege of being known as the model minority. And that kind of compounds all these other factors, which make us basically silenced by mainstream media.
So while on the topic of anti-Asian racism, as we see more dialogues and discourse starting to happen on social media, there's this whole narrative of how anti-Asian racism was not brought on by the pandemic. However, how do you think the pandemic has exacerbated anti-Asian discrimination? How has the pandemic highlighted this history of anti-Asian racism in Canada specifically?
I think it's definitely just made the silence that much louder, if that makes sense. Because if you think about the history of anti-Asian racism in Canada, you know, I went through the public school system in Toronto, specifically in Ontario, the public school system with, you know, the fixed curriculum of what you learn in history and that kind of thing. And as much as Canadian history classes failed to teach about things that happened during colonization or Indigenous peoples, at the same time, like, we never learned about the fact that Chinese people were enslaved not very long ago to build the Canadian railway. And like, my own grandparents had to pay the Chinese head tax, which was a racist head tax. And these things aren't really talked about. We don't talk about them. And there's kind of this stereotype around Asian people that a lot of Asian people, it's very culturally common. I don't want to speak for everyone, but I'm specifically Chinese, so I'll say, like, in my Chinese family, it's kind of common to keep your head down mentality, where it's like, my grandparents and my parents have for sure experienced racism, but it hasn't been to the extremity of which, you know, obviously Black or Indigenous communities have experienced. Thus, they've kind of kept their heads down because it was difficult, but it wasn't difficult enough to not put up with. I'm not saying that was the case for everyone, but I'm saying that was definitely a case, I think, that I've observed within my family and extended family and kind of my people of my culture. And because of that, people have gotten away with a lot. You know, growing up, obviously saying the N-word is not acceptable, but people would say the C word to me all the time and no one would flinch, right? It doesn't hold the same gravity as other slurs, such as the F word towards like the LGBTQ plus community or that kind of thing. People just don't see it as a problem. And because of that, I think that history of silence and also just dismissal has really just been amplified.
So going back to your article, you discussed the presence of anti-Asian rhetoric in the U.S. government, specifically by former President Trump, Do you think this harmful rhetoric is also present in Canada as well? I know that in Canada we have like the pseudo reputation of being the friendly, superior neighbor to America. And I want to talk about in Canada, we are also responsible for anti-Asian racism. It's in our history. It's in, it is in daily life. So I think that I'm wondering, do you find this the same rhetoric that we see in you with U.S. politicians present here?
I for sure do, not necessarily as explicitly as Trump, obviously, with politicians, because as we know, like Trump literally called it the Chinese virus. And there were White House officials calling it the Kung flu. So that type of tomfoolery isn't necessarily happening in Canada. I don't think people could get away with that in Canada, if I'm being honest. Maybe they could, but I think that the overall rhetoric is very much the same in the actual populations of Canada and US, the general public or dominant society, I would say. I think that associations of Chinese people with COVID are very, very xenophobic towards Asian people, obviously, but I think they also come from dominant Western society. That's, you know, they are responsible for propagating us with all sorts of stereotypes, including being unclean or having dietary habits that, you know, aren't very customary in the US or in Western society. So I think that all of these stereotypes have just built up and up and up and up over these years. And now COVID has kind of allowed for a scapegoat of all of this racism that is built up. And unfortunately, now we're seeing it to go past past the space of just words and, you know, anger and racism and that to that extent. And we're actually seeing violence and murder, which I don't think the Asian community has seen. It's kind of unprecedented and it's quite scary, but at the same time, you know, it's really eye-opening, I think, as an Asian person to think about how the Black community must feel or the Indigenous community must feel, the Indigenous communities must feel when they are experiencing this kind of violence every day. It like changes your perspective for sure, I think.
Going off of violence and treatment and harmful rhetoric, obviously, as you said, the Canadian government is not necessarily referring to the pandemic and the virus itself in an offensive way. However, do you think the Canadian government is doing a good job, has done a good job at condemning this harmful language, this surge of hate crimes against the community in general?
I don't think the Canadian government has done enough. We've seen a lot of businesses struggling, obviously, with COVID, but Chinatowns across the country, including Montreal's Chinatown, are really losing business and are also being, you know, vandalized and destroyed and targeted. And the individuals living in those neighborhoods and who, you know, dwell in those neighborhoods, all of the Asian community, are also feeling those, you know, feeling those consequences. And I think that the Canadian government needs to do a better job at supporting specifically Chinese people and Chinese businesses that are experiencing, you know, the obvious drawbacks of COVID-19 in terms of business, but only amplified by stereotypes of racism. Chinese restaurants are losing so much money simply because of stereotypes that, you know, they are associated with COVID-19. I've heard people say that they won't go to Chinatown simply because, you know, they fear that they may contract COVID-19, which makes no sense. That's just an association, a racist association between the two. But I think that overall, there needs to be more done to look out for the Asian community as a whole.
And we talked a bit about seeing more of this discussion about the history of anti-Asian racism and the present situation on social media. And so I'm wondering, What role has social media played in your mind in regards to this discussion around anti-Asian hate crimes and racism, and what more can be done on social media?
One thing that social media has done that has actually been of benefit to our community is the fact that certain incidents are actually being posted and have gone viral, and justice has been served kind of for those people. Perpetrators have been found. And I have seen for sure an influx of people posting about Asian American, Asian Canadian racism, which is something that I've never seen before. And it's a shame that things have had to go to this extremity for, you know, Asian American and Asian Canadian racism to even enter the discourse. But either way, I'm glad that it's there. At the same time, though, there's, again, this large silence that I see, especially after, you know, I feel like social media and activism really changed after the Black Lives Matter movement last summer, after the passing of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and many, 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 many more. I think that in seeing that influx of, you know, of activism, to see kind of the whole internet shut down, and then to see, you know, a 30-year-old Filipino man get kneeled on by a police officer and killed just a few days ago, and not really see anything. It speaks for itself. I think it speaks for itself. And as an Asian person, it's very isolating. It's isolating because you think this is happening, and it's happening in places where we live, and it's happening to people around us and people that look like my grandparents and my parents. And no one really cares. And the people that do care, you know, are not like it. It's for sure great. But at the same time, it's like, how can we feel like we are being addressed or heard when it's a minority of people that care and not necessarily majority? And also, I don't want to, you know, essentialize being, you know, an ally as just posting something on Instagram. Just because you don't post something on Instagram, that doesn't mean that, you know, you're not being an ally or helping people in your Asian community. But at the same time, it's been interesting to really like observe the trends online.
So this just sort of came to mind as you were talking, because throughout this interview, you've spoken a lot about how there's this lack of regard for just issues and racism and discrimination faced by Asian Americans, Asian Canadians. And I recall in the summer, I forget which university, but they sort of made a statement saying that Asian students will now be counted the same as white students. They'll no longer be seen as a minority. They will be considered the same as the white people. And I want to know how that sort of, I've seen that kind of coming up more and more. People saying that Asian demographics and white demographics are now in the same boat, essentially. And I want to ask you how you think that sort of, what consequences do you think that sort of decision and that new attitude towards Asian communities, what consequences does that have?
I think that really ties into the whole history of Asian people, specifically like Chinese people, being seen as this model minority, especially in Canada. I've personally experienced and I've seen a lot of racism towards Chinese people in Vancouver and in Toronto, in regards to, you know, the rhetoric of they stole our jobs or they're taking our housing and this whole thing. And the model minority complex is something that I think has really contributed to kind of the silence surrounding Asian racism, specifically because I think if people see us as a model minority or see us, you know, as their doctors or their lawyers or their dentists or whatever it may be, they think, oh, they're fine. They think they're fine, they're privileged. And I think what people fail to realize and to acknowledge is that not very long ago, Chinese people, as I said before, were being taxed simply to deter Chinese immigrants from Canada. That was something that the Canadian government put in place to discourage Chinese people from coming to this country. Not long ago, people were working on the Canadian railway. Chinese people were enslaved and thousands of them died. Not to mention that, you know, Chinese people have always experienced racism, and not just racism, but again, even before, not before, because the racism has always existed, but when things weren't as violent as they are now, I think one indicator that you can really look at is we're seen as this model minority that keeps our heads down, but how can you say, how can someone think that we are privileged to the same extent of white people when you look at simply the popular media that we consume? Look at Asian representation, look at the covers of magazines, look at toys, look at movies. And when you see Asian representation, look at if that representation is positive or negative. And even in looking at that, I think we can really see that kind of Asian people are seen as maybe an extra. We're seen as an extra, but we're not necessarily addressed. Our the breadth of our experiences and our oppression is not addressed because it's not seen as pressing enough to be addressed, because often people just see us and they think, well, they're successful enough.
Going back to your article, you mentioned that small gestures can help practice respect for East Asian Canadians and Americans. This includes smiling at someone on the sidewalk or supporting Asian businesses, which you also mentioned in this interview. Now that things have become more dire and East Asian folks face a bigger threat, especially when going out in public, what can we do beyond this to continue standing in solidarity with and supporting East Asian Canadians and Americans?
So I think, as I said before, one thing that's really important that you can do, like, in your everyday life is just to ensure that you're mindful in public spaces, that you're not inherently, you know, alienating or othering an East Asian person. That doesn't mean that, you know, you have to go give them a smile and have a conversation and introduce yourself and all these things. But just looking out around you, I mean, there's also resources. The Asian Americans Advancing Justice Organization actually put out a resource, and it's basically a guide to how to de-escalate a situation or be a bystander. And in the rare case that, you know, something like that does occur, my hope is that, you know, someone would step forward, someone would help. That's obviously on a case-to-case basis. Like, I don't know how often one is going to encounter these things, especially in, you know, I'm not quite aware of, like, where people are living and that kind of thing. But for example, in New York City, they established a neighborhood watch for the blocks of Chinatown. And they just had people making sure that, you know, everything was going smoothly in Chinatown, because there was a lot of racism that occurred in New York City's Chinatown, and also vandalism and the destroying of businesses and that kind of thing. Another thing is there's a site called Stop AAPI Hate, which is Asian American Pacific Islander Hate. And people can report hate incidents on there if they encounter them. And you can actually read about other people's incidences of hate. And I went on yesterday, actually, and read a few of them. And it really puts into perspective how serious and how degrading the situation is, how violent it is, and also just the effects, the impacts that it's having on the Asian community, the fear that it's spreading, the isolation that it's fueling. So this is a really great resource. Also, it gives further resources on how, where to go, how to deal with an incident of hate, where to report it, and that kind of thing. So I think these are all things that we can all educate ourselves on, whether we're Asian or not. This is a great way to kind of be an ally. And I think another really important part of that is just ensuring that you're keeping the discussion open, keeping this in your mind, reading the news, being aware of what's going on, acknowledging it, checking in on members of the East Asian community you may know around you, and just overall practicing human decency and compassion. I think it's not that hard.
And lastly, do you have any resources you would recommend for McGill students, a part of the East Asian community, school related or not?
Yeah, so I think that one thing that I've been a part of that I've really liked is PAC, the Pacific Asian Collective, and they specifically, like, anyone that's East Asian can be a part of it. And it's quite nice to have a place and a space where you can talk to other Asian people and meet other Asian people that understand the breadth of struggles that you're facing right now, or the isolation that you may face. Also, there are other Asian student organizations. I know there's a Hong Kong Student Association, Chinese Student Association, all these things that people can join. On top of that, one thing that isn't necessarily a resource, but something that's quite nice, is just going to Chinatown. If you're COVID safe, if you wear a mask, the stores are open now. And I went on Chinese New Year, Lunar New Year, and it was great. And just kind of interacting with, like, as a Chinese person, I didn't get to see my grandparents for the first time in, like, my life for Chinese New Year. And it was really nice and kind of refreshing and reassuring to just reimmerse myself in, you know, a little taste of the Chinese community and interact with some individuals there that run shops and support local businesses and that kind of thing. It's been really great for me as an Asian person, not only to, you know, in the context of this racism, but to also, you know, it's a very dark thing to think about a lot. And sometimes it's nice to just take your mind off of that and enjoy, you know, appreciate and enjoy the beauty of the actual culture and the community, rather than focus on what's going on, because it can be very draining sometimes. And I think members of the East Asian community at McGill should also be taking the time to just, you know, ensure that they're feeling safe, they're feeling okay, and understanding that this has nothing to do with our community and has everything to do with racism.
Thank you so much, Amanda. All the resources that Amanda has mentioned will be in our resource list, which is in our Instagram bio, in our link tree. So if you didn't catch them, don't worry, they'll be there. Also, to shout out Amanda once again, she and some folks at the PAC are currently working on a journal where Amanda will be publishing some of her work. So look out for that, because she's a very good writer and picks really interesting topics. So go, Amanda. Oh, she has one more thing to say.
And QPIRG, which is the Quebec Public Interest Research Group at McGill, is hosting an event series soon called Culture Shock, and it focuses on anti-oppression specifically. And this year's theme is kind of overcoming our current level of oppression and what that looks like in the future. And there is going to be a workshop held by PAC members talking about the commodification and fetishization of East Asian culture, which is tied into racism towards East Asian people and the Asian community as a whole. So that's also a great resource to check out. And all of those workshops will be available.
Thanks for tuning in this week for Unfit. Much appreciated. Come back next week at the same time for another show. All resources mentioned can be found on our resource list, which is in our link tree in our Instagram bio. Follow us there at unfit_toprint. Playing us out, we have Colors by Callie Technis.
CKUT.
It's on? It's on?
It's on?
CKUT 90.3. This is Kyle.
Si Angeliu vonga ulume maji 2021 tunga sugittini pibukkunnu maji 8 ngulakangaqvasu teqqattarput angnai pitjutigillugi ilisaqsivaklutalu angnai qanuilorninginni ulume angnai pitjutigillugi angnangni nipileorisimavugut oqaqateqaqqavunga Angela amaruarinmi ingiutileangani sanaqattartanginniklu Jennifer May okhakhatakhakpuk Kayla May Komik. Pilagari khattaktanga. Imminit nagligiktuk nukakik. Pikkugusuta khakhattaktillugit ang nokhatimingit mapukkini innang nildu. Tusangnak tiktinakpugut inuktok pinit nalagitti. I'm Nancy Angilak. Today is March 2nd, 2021 and welcome to Nipibut. On March 8th, each year we celebrate International Women's Day to recognize the achievements of women. Today, in honor of International Women's Day, we interview influential Inuit women. I speak with